The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Centre Parks. Escape to the forest and make unforgettable memories together.
9:25 and live and in glorious Technicolor in front of me in studio this morning, Robert Harris, author. Good morning, Robert. Nice to see you again.
Morning. How are you?
I feel like the two of us are exhaling after 2 years.
I know. It's so nice to see you face to face again.
Yeah.
I've got so sick of Zoom calls and the rest of it.
I'm kind of triggered by it. Somebody says we'll do that on a Zoom. I'm going, no.
No, I rather hate not. It. Hate it. It's so good to be out and about again and back in Dublin.
And congratulations on Act of Oblivion. It's just a terrific book. You must be thrilled with the reviews. They're glowing.
Yeah, Well, obviously, I am pleased. You finish a book, you never know what people are going to make of
yeah.
it. But this one does seem to have hit the court. And who would have thought that?
Well,
a couple of Puritan colonels on the run.
I tell you, I'm going to be straight with you because when I saw the blurb or the thoughts of what this book was about, I thought, oh no, Robert, I'm going to have to work for this because I know very little about the English Civil War, and I care probably even less. And then I picked it up. Within 2 pages, I thought, I want to devour every book I can on this subject. We have a very tricky relationship with Oliver Cromwell. We'll get to all of these things in a moment. But this is what you do. You take, and I love that, we'll talk about the macro, we'll get into the micro in a moment, where you take politics, essentially, from what feels like the modern age, and you simply put them into togas or roundheads or papal conclaves. Your books have that lovely sense of contemporary, and yet we're brought to totally different parts of the space-time continuum. Amazing.
Oh, well, thank you. That is, politics fascinates me, power, struggle for power. And actually, there is no, well, few better stories than the English Civil War because it was a real battle for power. And it shaped England, of course, but also Ireland and all the rest of Europe, really. It was a massive event to cut off the king's head in the 17th century and be a republic for 11 years. Yeah. I mean, it's absolutely breathtaking.
It really is. And that the fact that Britain was a republic for all those years, led by, you know, a man with little or no military experience, maybe no great ambition at the time. So let's talk about the book for a moment. If you could give us the nutshell versions to bring people along who haven't read it yet, which are probably most people, in fairness.
Yeah, sure. Well, the title Act of Oblivion comes from an actual parliamentary act, which was called, I think, something like the Act of Forgetting and Oblivion. This was passed in the summer of 1660 when Charles I's son, Charles, came back from exile and Parliament invited the king to come back. And under the provisions of this act, all the crimes of the Civil War, taking up arms against the king, all of that was forgiven and forgotten. That was the deal. But there was one exception, and that was anyone who'd signed a death warrant or been a judge of Charles I. They were required to surrender for the king's mercy. There were 59 signatories of the death warrant and about 100 or so judges. A lot of them had died, of course, but those that were still alive, they all had to give themselves up. Those that gave themselves up were very stupid to do so because it quickly became apparent that there wasn't going to be any mercy. And a lot of the others fled. They fled to Holland, Switzerland, Germany. And the two that I follow, I find most interesting, fled to America. Father-in-law and son-in-law, two colonels. The older one was Cromwell's cousin. And they went on the run together. And this is all true.
Yes.
What I invented was a man on their tail, a regicide hunter, the man who coordinates the hunt for all of these characters. He's called Richard Naylor. He works for the Privy Council. And so I cut between these two, the chaser and the chased.
And what a hunt it is. It reminded me of sometimes like a Western.
Yes, I thought a bit of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid when I was writing
like
it.
That.
Yes, because I thought, how do I humanise these colonels? I mean, Puritans in themselves are pretty hard, tough to take, 17th century Puritan. But a 17th century Puritan colonel is really going it. Who killed the king? So they call themselves, they're Ned and Will. And I did find sympathetic sides to them, actually. And also, as a reader, you're always on the side of the people on the run, I think.
Yes.
Or if you're at the cinema. And they're just being pursued by the man in the white hat every time they think they've reached safety.
Yes.
Here he comes again. Yeah. And they had a big reward on their heads. And they were hidden by the Puritan community in New England, and they hid in cellars and in attics and in barns, and sometimes they were out in the open in caves. It's a story of survival, really.
The man in the white hat who was pursuing them, of course, had a run-in with the two fellas, which kind of underlies his hunger for revenge. It wasn't just about hunting down regicides. There was more to it. We don't need to get into it. I don't want to spoil. Thanks. But the point I suppose I'm making is that the reason that he comes into it is because they were at a nativity event, and this is one of the things that people always talk about, the puritanicals and Puritans. They banned Christmas, and they took unkindly to music and theatre and the arts. I mean, they were a very particular type of religiosity, wasn't it?
It was. Well, before I started the book, I'd always thought, I've always been interested in the Civil War, and I've always thought that I'd be a roundhead, you know, I'd be on the parliamentary side. I finished it realising I'm actually one of life's cavaliers, you know. I like the theatre, the music, and I like Christmas.
Yeah.
And so they're real political extremists. They're really kind of the 17th century equivalent of ISIS or the Taliban. They are
that bad.
Yeah, they defaced churches, tore out altar rails, tore down statues and paintings in church. But Cromwell himself burnt a lot of it. They went on the rampage, destroying all images, very much like the Taliban. They suppressed Christmas. The incident in the novel where Wally and Gough come in to the private chapel on the Strand and break up the Christmas service, that is described in John Evelyn's diaries. They actually, these two guys did it.
Yeah.
So I put in that congregation the man who later will come after them, Naylor. And yes, they abolished all this, closed down the theatres and so on. And they were alert for any backsliding. You know, it was their way or the highway, really.
Isn't it funny how it was all about God and how God-fearing they were and whatever? But the bloodthirsty savagery. I mean, your description of, I always think you were hung, drawn and quartered. Never read it in its visceral description the way you do. Could you tell us, with all the gory glory that you do, what hung, drawn and quartered means and
well,
that so
yes.
many people were?
Okay, those of a nervous disposition.
Turn off now.
Come back in 30 seconds. Yes, well, you were dragged on a kind of gate or hurdle through the streets of London, over the cobbles, for all the way from the Tower of London to Tyburn. Or some of these were actually executed at Charing Cross so they could see the banqueting house where the king had been killed. Then you made a speech. They made long speeches to the thousands there. Then they were hanged until they were unconscious. Then they were cut down. Then they were revived. Then they were castrated. And then their stomachs were opened and their entrails pulled out. I mean, 30 feet of entrails and burnt in front of them. And then they got down to business, really. And so what is extraordinary, though, is how many of them, almost all of them, went to this death, this terrible death, almost happily,
yes.
because they thought that this is suffering like Christ's and that they would be in heaven very shortly. And they were regarded it as a kind of badge of honour. I mean, one of them, actually, Major General Harrison, who was the first to be executed, actually somehow managed to work his arm free and he hit the executioner in the side of the head. I mean, these were tough guys. These were revolutionaries, you know, and formidable,
yes.
formidable characters.
You know, I was in London yesterday, and when you're passing through Westminster, especially this week of weeks, we'll talk about that later, and you see a statue of Oliver Cromwell and you think, how is he still there, right? Now, you're on Irish turf today, Robert, and I think that I get the sense that British people have a very interesting relationship with Oliver Cromwell. I want to talk to you about it now, because if we were in a population of, say, 2 million and 200,000 people are slaughtered by one man's hand, essentially, obviously he wouldn't be considered a great hero here. Where does he stand in British history, and how is he still considered to be such a... what I'll say is, as a subplot to my point, is this. Part of me was thinking, should we not, as Irish people, be rooting for Cromwell at one point as a Republican, as somebody who's not into the monarchy? A very peculiar diversity of feeling here.
Yes. Well, I mean, of course, I appreciate the sensibilities in Ireland. And it was a great relief to me to find that neither Wally nor Gough, my heroes in the sense of the book, came to Ireland on that terrible expedition in 1649. And indeed, Edward Wally, the older of the two, opposed the expedition and opposed the punitive sanctions and the transplanting and the rest of it.
Yeah.
Cromwell it's an absolute irony that Cromwell's statue stands outside the Houses of Parliament, because no man in history has closed down Parliament more often than Oliver Cromwell, once famously with a file of soldiers. He was a military dictator. He was an extraordinary figure. There's no doubt about that. That he had a curious blend of characteristics of otherworldliness and ambition, of sentimentality and cruelty. He believed he was doing God's work, and this is one of the things that is a strand in my books. Whenever people feel something like that, be careful, because they feel that they are licensed to do anything. God is allowing them to do it. And so I'm sure he went to his grave with an untroubled conscience about the massacres in Ireland, because he would have believed that this was God's will. It was happening because God willed it.
Let me ask you a bit about the fact that the two, as you call them, heroes, made their way across the Atlantic Ocean, and America was kind of starting out with the colonists. And you get the sense, whether it's through Second Amendment, love of guns, or again, that's intense religious fervor, that even in 17th century America, as it was starting off then, that maybe that's where it all started. That sense that of what we now see, whether it's the Capitol Hill riots or, you know, that certain tranche of opinion in modern day America. You can trace it back centuries.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. I think the DNA of America today is laid down in the 17th century, a fundamental strand of it, and that is, well, first of all, anti the British monarchy. That strain, the Puritan communities in North America were very slow and reluctant to recognise Charles II. And one of the reasons these guys were able to stay alive was because the Puritans protected them. Mm-hmm. So you've got that. They had militias, and Wally and Gough, being two of the most experienced soldiers in the world, really, trained the militias. Mm-hmm. And there was a sort of embryo army to take on the British there. They started to think that maybe we could stand against the English if they come for us. You have the religious fervour, which you still see. There are still towns in New England that are dry, you know, and you can't get an alcoholic drink. And their peculiar attitude to drink, you know, you have to be over 21 to have a drink. And yet you can go and buy the most deadly assault weapons when you're a teenager.
Yes.
I mean, it's all these things, and the overturning of Roe v. Wade, for instance, at a time when the rest of the world, like Ireland, are all, you know, keener on allowing women the right to have that choice if they want. All these, I think, you can trace back to that Puritan beginning.
But let's go with that thought for a moment, the Roe versus Wade overturning and the kind of post-Trump, I know he's still there, but post-Trump 4 years, if you like, lurched to the far right, the mad right in some ways. I mean, look, I'm not giving out about the right. The right is the right, the left is the left. But that other world we're talking about, that has shades of Puritanism. That has shades of, for certainly, stepping back. People talk about Gilead and, you know, the Handmaid's Tale vibe off it, and certainly reading your book, and when you've got God on your side, there's no such thing as wrong.
Yes, I mean, I'm not sure about the theology, but I think a lot of the fundamentalist Christian right there support Israel, for instance, because they believe that is the harbinger of the second coming.
Which features in your book.
These guys, millennialists, one of the reasons they kept on running was they were sure that in a few years, in 1666, Christ would return to earth, and the rule of the saints would begin, and they would be among the elect. And this is very serious belief, and this persists today. And I think any visitor to America for the first time is struck by the religious radio programs and broadcasts and the extent that this, you know, is in modern American politics. It's, I can't think of any other country that's like that.
Your love of politics is if I could say so, matched by my own. I'm fascinated by it because your dad didn't, he was never really into sport. And while I do, and I'm sure you're the same, admire and appreciate sport, politics is your sport and my sport. And I always say the American presidential elections are our Olympics, aren't they? And, you know, the others are kind of different European championships or whatever. You know, you have analogies.
The four nations.
yeah, whatever you want to call it. But with that in mind, you know, you look at American politics. You were a friend of Tony Blair's. I notice everyone says that in the past tense. Why is that?
Well, that might be because of my novel, The Ghost, and the
characterization.
The suggestion that he is aimlessly living a life in fear of a war crimes prosecution. He was a friend. Someone asked me about it the other day, and did I have any contact? And I don't really, but I still do get a Christmas card. I'm on some computer-generated list. Obviously, they can't switch off in some way. But you know, I don't think there's any great hard feelings, at least. You know,
do you think history will be kind to Tony Blair, or will history judge him harshly?
I think it'll be a mixed verdict. I think they will have to say he was an immensely gifted politician who won three general elections. But then it all started to go wrong. And no, I can't see how history is ever going to say that the Iraq invasion of Iraq was anything other than a blunder.
He'll get marks for effort for the Northern Ireland peace process, no doubt. But the Iraq thing was just a fiasco.
And I think modernising the message of the left and for sheer political genius. I mean, if you and I like politics as the ultimate contact sport in a way, he knew how to play that game. Mm. Cameron and people like that used to call him the master privately. You know, and they couldn't believe their luck when Labour got rid of him.
Yes, of course. And let's talk about that because maybe the Keir Starmer can't believe his luck that they got rid of Boris in some respects. I mean, that, what was that like? Because I'm watching it from across the Irish Sea, glued to the Johnson era, the fact that he got there, the fact that Theresa May was so short-lived, getting Brexit done, the parties and so forth, and then obviously the dethroning of Boris. How has it been for you the last couple of years watching all this unfold?
Well, you know, you feel you're trying to make up a story and and invent characters, and you can't do anything to compete with what's going on in reality. Yeah. I mean, it has been extraordinary. It's been a crazy 6 years in Britain ever since that wretched referendum. It's like living in sort of, you know, Italy or France at the end of the 19th century. You know, prime ministers come and go, governments rise and fall. There's a sense of corruption, of strange people being put in the House of Lords. It feels very fin de siècle. It feels very like the end of days in some strange and awful way.
It's only 2022.
I know. So, it's a bit of a relief to go to the gentle English Civil War period of political stability almost.
But given how febrile and how extraordinary the times we're living, I can't remember anything like it. I've been saying here the last few weeks that I don't think it would be wise to rule out a comeback from Boris Johnson.
No, I think, excuse me, I think he's very likely to come back.
As PM?
Quite possibly. I mean, he will. One of the ways I know Johnson is that he's obviously mad keen on Roman history, and he reviewed two of my books on Cicero, and then when it was adapted by the Royal Shakespeare Company, he went about three times to see it. He's obsessed by Roman politics, and Cicero dreamed of the second consulship, that he would come back to power. And I'm sure that Johnson is like that. He looks at politics in that sense, as something, as an arena for ambition, in which, you know, the lone man comes and fights his way back. And he will try and do it, in my opinion, either to come back as leader of the Conservative Party, or if he can't do that, to run rather like Teddy Roosevelt at the beginning of the 20th century in America, on a different party. I mean, he's a populist. A tribune of the people, if you like, is probably how he sees himself.
Yes.
I may be wrong, but I feel he's got a glint in his eye. He's not happy at all. He feels that he won this huge 80-seat majority and the buggers threw him out, and I think he's going to brood. I mean, he talked about Cincinnatus anyone who knows about Roman history knows the famous thing is that Cincinnatus was recalled from his
He came back. Let's compete the troika here of historical reference points for Boris Johnson, which is, of course, that Winston Churchill was written off once upon a time too, wasn't he? His beloved historical figure.
Yes, exactly. In politics, it isn't over till it's over, you know, and as long as you're still hanging around, it's like a great wheel turns, and at one minute you're utterly finished, and then bizarrely, months or years later, you're suddenly back on top again, and we'll just have to wait and see. But he's a bit of a nightmare for the Conservative Party, I think.
And even the fact that Liz Truss's victory was not exactly overwhelming, and certainly not the way the polls have been suggesting against Rishi Sunak. And also equally, it seems that the party faithful, so-called, really didn't want him to go at all.
No, the party faithful didn't want him to go, and she didn't get a majority of MPs. And, you know, it's a really ruthless operation, the Conservative Party, and full of ambition and intrigue and backstabbing. And
sounds like any of your books.
I know. You're spoilt for choice where to go, actually.
Now, you start your books around, as I understand it, kind of mid-January, and you keep going for 6, 7, 8 months. So what are we on now, September? Have you started the next one, or are you taking a breather to
publicize this? Well, I'm enjoying, actually, the freedom to go out and travel and talk about this
one, which
I wasn't able to do for the last one. So it's 3 years since I've been to Ireland or indeed travelled a lot around the UK. So it's I thought I'd put aside September and October to actually, you know, go out and see
and enjoy it.
Yeah, and you know, take the book out and go around and meet people. So it may mean that I won't be able to start a new book in January. I've got a few ideas, and if I can do it, I mean, one of the things I discovered when I wrote The Ghosts Say is you can actually write a book pretty fast if you know what you want to do.
It's there.
Yeah, you can do it in 3 or 4 months, actually. But sometimes a book like this one took months of research, which I did in the long, cold lockdown, you know, the one where we lost Christmas, and I just stayed and worked on it then.
Christmas wasn't cancelled by the Puritans.
Karen
says, I love this period in history. I can't wait to read Robert's book. Did he use Pepys' diaries as a source? And yours, that's a yes?
Yes, I certainly use those.
And another says, on a never-ending paint job here in Galway, I just bought Act of Oblivion as an audiobook narrated by Tim McInerney, which will pass the next 15 hours and 42 minutes wonderfully.
He does it very well. I've only heard a clip of it, but he's got a rich voice and he does all the voices, accents very well.
I had trouble putting the book down. It's one of my books of the year 2022 without question, and I just loved it so much. So it's been great to have you in studio to talk to you, Robert, in real life, and thanks for that. I just loved it so much. Act of Oblivion, great to talk to you as always.
Great to see you.
Nice
thanks
see
so
you.
Much
Robert Harris, live in studio this morning at 12 minutes to 10.